Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week I'll be talking with actors Lorenzo Pugliese and Daria Pilar Reedus, who play the parts of SpongeBob SquarePants and his squirrel girlfriend, Sandy Cheeks, in the SpongeBob musical just in town through this Sunday. I'll talk with Bay Area actress and favorite Monique Hafen-Adams, who stars as Roxy Hart in the new San Jose Stage Company's production of the Tony Award-winning musical, Chicago. Also down south in San Jose, I'll be talking with Opera San Jose's music director and principal conductor, Joseph Marcheso, about their production of Verdi's Il Trovatore. And from the ridiculous and sublime and classic Broadway, we take a turn and a deep breath into mindfulness for something completely different. And I'll talk with pianist and meditation expert Murray Hittery about these upcoming meditative musical mind travel experience at the Aquarium of the Bay coming up on February 16th. Stay with us. Start out on the operatic front on this edition of Open Air. This month, Opera San Jose highlights the raw emotions that drive Giuseppe Verdi's turbulent tale of love and revenge in its production of Il Trovatore. A terrific cast, and the principal conductor joins me in studio, Joseph Marcheso, the music director and principal conductor of Opera San Jose. He's conducted some 22 productions for the organization, including the West Coast premiere of Putz and Campbell's Silent Night and the world premiere of Mark Weiser's Where Angels Fear to Tread. Previously music director of the Amato Opera in New York City, but long now established here on this coast. Welcome back, Joseph.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back.
Well, opera with an exclamation mark when it comes to Verdi and Il Trovatore. Let's first talk about the very busy time that this was for Verdi. You know, he was writing Rigoletto. He had a commission here, a commission there.
I think it probably comes out during his breakout. This is right in the middle. I guess this is 1851. It's right after Rigoletto, which kind of catapulted him further. I mean, he had probably at this point written 15, 16 operas. I guess his first breakout was Nabucco, and then there was a long string of operas, some more well-known than others. In fact, Hernani, which San Francisco Opera is doing in the summer, one of the major ones, Macbeth, which West Bay actually is doing right now as well. So a lot of middle Verdi in the Bay Area. Then with Rigoletto, then Il Trovatore, and then Traviata, which came right after this one. And so with those three, he became the leading Italian opera composer of the time. And then, of course, there was still Aida, Don Carlo, Balamascara, Otello, Falstaff, the ones that have really cemented his place in history.
Mm. And just the actually more popular than critical success that this opera had, an astonishing 229 productions worldwide in just the 3 years following its premiere in 1853. In Naples, for example, where the opera had 11 staging in its first year, in six theaters, and performances of a total of 190 performances.
It's really the most popular opera in his day. Certainly by the time he died in 1901, he would have thought that this would have been his most enduring success.
Well, recently retired General Director Larry Hancock will offer a free 45-minute talk about the opera before each of the performances. Can you offer us a little bit of Opera 101 for those not familiar with the very dramatic libretto, which actually the character Ferrando offers right off the bat in a classic exposition that starts the opera?
Yes, there are a few. I mean, Ferrando has a narration about what happens, and then Azucena has a kind of counter-narration. So there are two major narrations that bring to scope a story that actually begins before the curtain opens. There is a long simmering vendetta between the Count de Luna, his father, and Azucena's mother, because of a fear that Azucena's mother was casting spells on his son, and through a very famous, I guess, in the opera world, mistaken identity. In an attempt to get retribution, she tries to kill his baby and accidentally kills her own, and so takes his baby and raises it as her own. So it's about two brothers who don't recognize and realize they're brothers, and so end up becoming rivals for a woman. And the consequences that come from having the truth being kept from them throughout the story, and finally the very sad and tragic denouement that happens because of it.
It's drama for sure.
It is, absolutely. It's drama. Elemental from beginning to end. And I think that's why it is so popular. The protagonists are very action-oriented, are very committed in their decisions, and are put in a position of an extremely dramatic situation and rise to the occasion of that situation.
Mm-hmm. For the more familiar, on the more familiar front, this opera has been featured in many popular areas, including probably its most famous
Absolutely.
Scene of comic chaos plays out over a performance of Il Trovatore in the Marx Brothers film, A Night at the Opera.
I actually knew the opera before I saw the movie, and it was both hilarious and enlightening. It must have been a very cultivated time that you could do a comedy that broadly based on an opera, knowing that many people in the audience would be quite familiar with that.
Right.
And in fact, there are interpolations that were created in that movie that now people insert in the opera. There's a couple of high C's and stuff that I think that movie was the first to popularize or even do. And now when you go to see it, you're kind of expecting to hear it that way because of that.
Well, the great Enrico Caruso said once that all it takes for a successful performance of Il Trovatore is the four greatest singers in the world. And you and your team have assembled quite an impressive group.
Yeah, absolutely. And every time that we do Trovatore, that quote is part of the lore of Trovatore. And you're mindful that when you're putting on something like that, you need to find four people who are equal to that challenge. And in our capacity, because we're trying to find people who've never done the role before, we have a lot of role debuts, and that's something that we're looking for. We're trying to find the four most promising artists in the world and giving them the opportunity to showcase what they can do and to, you know, and not many opera companies of any size do as many performances as we do. We do six performances. San Francisco does five or six. You have to go to the Met, I guess, to go to a place that reliably does more than six performances. So when you have someone who's doing a role for the first time and they're having six goes at it, each of those performances is very interesting and revelatory, both for them and for us watching them develop how they're going to approach particularly these roles, which mm-hmm. are gigantic.
And you have a couple of shared roles as well. Tenors Mackenzie Gotcher and Alexander Boyer alternate as Manrico.
Correct.
And baritones Sung-hyun Baek and Eugene Brancoviano alternate as Count de Luna. How does that work given that there are just so few performances? Who sings what? Is this one covering the same? Everyone must be at all the rehearsals, right?
Yeah. Part of it, we have a Saturday-Sunday. And so there, it would be very cruel to ask Manrico, the tenor, to sing both a Saturday evening and a Sunday afternoon back to back. He has, I mean, that's, I don't, there are not many tenors, I think, who could do it, let alone would want to do that.
Right.
And Alex Boyer is a former resident, and when he sang his first Manrico, he sang it with us. So it seemed natural to ask him to come back because he's more familiar with the role and the production, so that we could spend time on each of them. Same with Eugene. Actually, both Eugene and Sung Hyun are both premiering this role for the first time. It's done on an individual case and basis, how we divide the rehearsals up. But we have, in a previous iteration, we've had a resident company in which we did two different casts for all the operas. So we are well experienced in dividing rehearsal time between people. And everyone generally does come to all of the rehearsals, so that most of the time, I mean, there is some ambient griping, but most of the time people recognize this hurdle and fit themselves in accordingly.
Mm-hmm. The house theater for Opera San Jose is the beautiful California theater.
Absolutely.
Works well for opera there.
The acoustics are fantastic, and I was speaking to Daryl Friedman, who's our Azucena, who's debuting that role as well. And she was telling me how, because you know, she's new to the theater and our company, and she was reacting for the first time about what it's like singing there with the orchestra, and how bolstered and secure she feels singing there, because the acoustic is so ideal for singers. They feel that they are projecting, and they are, to the very end of the hall. It's 1,100 seats, which is a good size European house, but for Americans, I think, used to the War Memorial or the Metropolitan, is an intimate evening.
Mm-hmm. And you, as a flutist, I noticed you recently had a flute opening. Did you do the successful audition for that?
It's Monday.
Oh, it's this coming
You
Monday.
Have time. You have time. We'll send you the list. You have time. Yeah, Monday we have our flute auditions.
I was seriously contemplating it, and then I had a shoulder operation, so I've got a little, not, didn't have the practice.
Do you want us to hold it? You want us to hold it for you?
Well, do the audition this fall.
We have a sub list. We have a sub list.
Okay. I know Isabel quite well. We'll have to talk to her on that one. Speaking of the rest of the season, I talked last week with Donato Cabrera.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. Yes. He's coming to do Figaro. No, flute.
Magic Flute.
Magic Flute.
Mozart.
It's his first time, I think, with us. I know him very well. We've gone to Cabo a couple times. He's truly a warm and wonderful guy, and I'm happy that I get to invite him to come, because I think he'll have a wonderful time. And it's a wonderful production as well, actually.
Nice. And you also recently announced the 2021 season.
Absolutely. We announced it at the end of January. We're doing The Marriage of Figaro, set in India during the period of the British Raj, which is quite a thing. We're going to have a new production, of course, for it, and that's had a lot of casting for it. We're probably almost done. And after that, we have Carmen, a very popular work that speaks for itself. And then we're doing a company debut of Zalame. I think not only is it the first time we're doing Zalame, it's the first time any Richard Strauss work has been done. And that's something I have wanted to do for a while and is a long time in coming. And we're going to do a very interactive production of that. We're going to have the orchestra on the stage and then the set in front of that. And that one, I actually am. As much as I'm excited for all the others, I'm particularly excited for Zalame. And then West Side Story, never done a musical
Fantastic.
Before.
Nice.
So we've a lot of people have asked us about it. And Corey Destour, our new general director, she loves that title. And we're very excited to experiment with that and see how our audiences react to that and help incorporate that work in a more operatic nature, especially now because it's going on Broadway. And I think next year they're coming out with a new movie. So it's in the air, that title. And we were lucky that they granted us the rights to that, given how desirable it's going to be during this period.
Right. Well, of course, learn more at operasj.org. Il Trovatore, Verdi's classic, opens this Saturday with six performances through March 6th. Let's go out with, you know, even if you don't know Il Trovatore, you'll know this music. Set up for us the anvil chorus, would you?
Sure. And a small thing in the anvil chorus, most of the time, and we do it as well, they have people on stage striking the anvil because it's notated in the score that it comes out in a very specific place. And we had a heck of a time coordinating the stage anvils to the orchestra, but it's now sounds like $1 million. The anvil chorus is in the first act. We switch to Azucena and the gypsy encampment where she lives with her fellow gypsies, and we open the scene with them at work. They're forging swords, they're gathering food, they're lighting fires, they're preparing the scene for Azucena to give us her counter-narrative about who she is, where she comes from, and her deeply loving but also strained relationship with her son, who doesn't totally know the truth of how he came to be with them and her.
Soap opera without the soap here.
Indeed.
In Il Trovatore, music of Giuseppe Verdi. Thanks for coming in, Joseph.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The Anvil Chorus from Il Trovatore, music of Giuseppe Verdi, being done by the Opera San Jose Company through March 1st. Information at operasj.org. Well, let's stay down on the peninsula in San Jose for a little bit. I don't know if Roxy Hart in Chicago was forging license plates with anvils, but maybe my guest Monique Haven Adams can enlighten me on that. Chicago is down at San Jose Stage Company on South 1st Street through March 15th. It's Broadway's longest-running American musical, nominated for 1975 Tony Awards, was the 1997 Tony Award winner for Best Revival, a book by Fred Ebb and Bob Fosse with music by the great John Kander and Fred Ebb of Cabaret fame, a show that was bound for Broadway glory and subsequent film glory with Richard Gere cast in the key character of Billy Flynn. The story is a satire on 1920s Chicago corruption in the administration of criminal justice and the concept of the celebrity criminal. Here in the Bay Area, the production at San Jose Stage casts Keith Pinto in the Billy Flynn role and my guest, Monique Hafen-Adams, in the key role of Roxy Hart. Monique is no stranger to the San Jose stage, as she's been featured in productions of Sweeney Todd, The Threepenny Opera, and Avenue Q. She's fresh off a Pride and Prejudice production at Theater Works. And my personal favorite memory of Monique's thespian magic comes multifold from SF Playhouse Productions, where she just killed it in the Playhouse production of the Burt Bacharach Hal David Promises, singing and accompanying herself on guitar for the classic I'll Never Fall in Love Again. Goosebumps here on that one. And wowed me as Guinevere and Camelot, nailed it in She Loves Me, Into the Woods, and was a riot as Amy in Sondheim's Company. But that's just a few of the many Bay Area productions you may have seen her in, from the stages of the aforementioned SF Playhouse, ACT, Center Rep, and others. Monique, welcome back to Open Air.
Thank you so much for a lovely introduction. They can't see me, but I'm blushing.
Well, I've still got goosebumps from those performances.
That's so it's very sweet. Thank you.
So now taking on the classic role of Roxy Hart, gosh, Gwen Verdun and Ryan King, do you have to take a page from those esteemed predecessors, or do you craft your own interpretation?
Oh, no. I think I tried to get my hands on as much material as possible, looking at the film version, Renee Zellweger, Gwen Verdun, Anne Rankin, there's a Ginger Rogers movie called Roxy Hart, and
wow,
stealing a little bit from her as well. So just trying to get my hands on as much material as possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, Anne Reinking won a Tony and Drama Desk Award as choreographer, in addition to playing Roxy in the 1996 revival. You've also done your share of work as choreographer, I believe.
Oh, I don't know that
some
I
staging, no.
I don't know that I have. Well, I wish.
Maybe take a page out of Anne Rankin's resume.
Maybe I
start
will.
Start working on that.
I don't know.
Tracy Freeman is the choreographer for the San Jose Stage Company, apparently staying as true as possible to the Bob Fosse original work.
Yeah, she has...
Quite provocative, over the top.
Yes. She has some... Our cast is amazing ensemble. They're all like... over 6 feet tall. They're just gorgeous to watch and doing original Bob Fosse choreography. And Tracy's done a great job putting that all together in such a small space, too.
Yeah. Have you taken on this role before?
I haven't. Oh, no, so it's not a lot of times you get to do it in a regional professional company because it has been on Broadway for so long.
Mm-hmm. Well, seeing as you're so rich with research on the role, this is truly a groundbreaking musical in so many ways, and the storyline especially, having two very bad girls as leads. Tell us first about your character, Roxy Hart.
Oh, Roxy. doesn't do a lot of nice things, and she's very narcissistic and very ambitious, and uses all those tools to get what she wants in the end. And it's been a tough role to present to audiences, especially the play version versus the movie. The movie portrays Roxy more as a lost puppy, and has more of that in her storyline than in the play, where it starts with her, no explanation, murdering her lover.
He had it coming, though, didn't he? He had it coming. Maybe not.
Did he? Does anybody?
That's a tune from Chicago, by the way.
Yes.
It's not my conjecture.
Good. I'm glad you explained that. But yeah, it's been a difficult role, but definitely just so much fun to deal with those huge emotions that these characters have and seeing those amazing, iconic songs.
Mm. So we talked about Roxy, bad girl. Now your friend, fellow prisoner, and show partner, Velma Kelly, who Cheetah Rivera portrayed in the original 1976 and then was taken on by Bebe Neuwirth and... Anne Reinking? No, Anne Reinking was your character.
Yes, though maybe Anne did Velma at some point too.
Maybe so.
It's on run for so long.
Who's Velma?
Allison Rich, one of the associate artistic directors down at the stage. You may have seen her in many of the performances. She was in Sweeney Todd with me as Mrs. Lovett. Just a powerhouse on stage, and we love working together.
That's so wonderful to hear that you know, have colleagues that you can really just play off of and play with.
Yeah, she definitely comes on stage with a lot of energy, and you just got to bring it with you.
It's being directed by Randall King, who's also the artistic director of the company.
Yes, it's been really lovely to work with him, founder of the company for years and years now, too.
So tell us a little bit about Velma. We heard the actress's name, Allison Rich, but who is Velma compared to Roxy?
Velma, compared to Roxy, from Roxy's point of view, Velma is this amazing vaudeville star who kills her husband after she finds out he's having an affair. Kills her husband and her sister.
Oh, my.
Yes. And they meet in prison and thus begins this rivalry between them as Roxy's fame grows and Velma's fame dwindles. And then find that by combining forces, they're able to rise both their star power.
And combining lawyer, I believe, as well.
Yes,
right?
That's true. That's and the scary thing is this is all based on true events. So,
really?
Yes. So it's all something that happened and... It's a little frightening to know that.
Wait till musicals are written about this era.
Oh, oh boy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We want to go there.
There's a lot of
Melania, the musical.
It's interesting to do the show now. It's set 100 years ago in the 1920s.
It's hard to believe that's 100 years
ago. Isn't that so crazy? And it's just like there's like a lot of the same awful things that are still happening today.
And the profession of lawyerdom hasn't changed much either. Tell us about
Billy
Flynn.
Well, my dad's a lawyer, so I can't be too harsh.
But tell us about the character Billy Flynn.
Billy Flynn, played by Keith Pinto, another local favorite in the Bay Area. He comes in, and as long as you give him the amount of money, $5,000, which back in 1920 was $100,000, he's happy to lie about who you are and what your story is to get you off.
Sounds like the Roy Cohn story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually have been watching OJ versus the People to kind of get that feeling of what celebrity does in a courtroom.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've tackled on some significant Broadway leads in your career. Who would you like to add to your resume after this role?
Ooh, I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of roles that I like need to wait for, like Mama and Gypsy and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So things to look forward to.
All right. Well, San Jose Stage Company's production of Chicago opened on February 5th and runs through March 15th. TheStage.org for more information. Monique Haven-Adams in the role of Roxy Hart, the name that's going to be on everyone's lips, I believe. Thanks for coming in, Monique.
Thanks so much.
The name on everybody's lips is gonna be Roxy. The lady raking in the chips is gonna be Roxy. I'm gonna be a celebrity. That means somebody everyone knows. They're gonna recognize my eyes, my hair, my teeth, my boobs, my nose. From just some dumb mechanic's wife, I'm gonna be Roxy. Who says that murder's not an art? And who, in case she doesn't hang, can say she started with a bang? Roxy Hart. I gotta get me some boys. I'm gonna get me a whole bunch of boys.
They're gonna wait outside in line to get to see Roxy.
Think of those autographs I'll sign. Good luck to ya, Roxy. And I'll appear in a lavalier that goes all the way down to my waist.
Here a ring, there a ring, everywhere a ring-a-ling.
But always in the best of taste. I'm a star, and they love me, and I love them, and they love me for loving them, and I love them for loving me, and we love each other,
That's because none of us got enough love in our childhood. And that showbiz kid.
She's giving up her humdrum life.
I'm gonna be Roxy.
She made a scandal and a star.
And Sophie Tucker, oh shit, I know.
Ah!
To see her name yet billed below.
Foxy, Roxy, art.
One of the classic tunes from Chicago, Candor and Ebb musical, currently at the Stage down in San Jose. Everyone's name on everyone's lips is going to be, I think, Monique Haven Adams. Paul Bolton of Broadway World called Allison Rich as Velma and Monique as Roxy, a powerhouse duo that sing, dance, and maneuver their way flawlessly through the show. And Monique is called a package of onstage dynamite by Michael Vaughn of Operaville. How about that? A little later in the hour, we'll be talking with Murray Hittery about a dip into mindfulness here in San Francisco. But let's go a little nuts now. It's the music that starts the cartoon series SpongeBob SquarePants and is played at the end of the musical version, currently at the Golden Gate Theater. The series chronicles the adventures and endeavors of the title character and his aquatic friends in the fictional underwater city of Bikini Bottom. It's the fifth longest running American animated series. Its popularity has made it a media franchise. It's the highest-rated series to air on Nickelodeon and Viacom CBS Domestic Media Network's most distributed property. As of late 2017, the media franchise has generated some $13 billion in merchandising revenue for Nickelodeon. And many of the series' original ideas come from The Intertidal Zone, which was an unpublished educational book that marine science educator and animator Steven Hillenburg created in 1989 to teach his students about undersea life. SpongeBob SquarePants has won a variety of awards as a musical, including 6 Annie Awards, 8 Golden Reel Awards, no, actually the animated series, 8 Golden Reel Awards, 4 Emmy Awards, 16 Kids' Choice Awards, and 2 BAFTA Children's Awards. Joining me in studio to talk about the musical version are two of the key cast members, SpongeBob himself, played by Lorenzo Pugliese, and playing Sandy Cheeks, Daria Pilar Redis. Welcome to you both.
Hi there.
How are you doing?
Wow, I'm exhausted from last night, as you must be as well.
Used to it by now.
Yeah.
Well, let's start with you, Vince. In addition to the Tom Kenny cartoon portrayal, you had to be channeling Martin Short and Pee Wee Herman in your interpretation. How did you come across to bring SpongeBob the cartoon to a life-size character?
You know, I really have to credit just about all of it to Tina Landau. Just the groundwork that she has put in over the course of, what is it, 6-7 years to really figure out how to, you know, translate the super iconic character onto a stage setting is just brilliant and super helpful.
Yeah, you have to give a shout out to the designers who could have gone with making you look like a sponge, you know, a yellow sponge, but instead they went more geeky.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that was it's super cool to again kind of translate these cartoon characters onto stage in a way that's more identifiable and relatable with a human audience.
Uh-huh. So what sort of challenges faced you in bringing such an iconic fictional character to life without just imitating Kenny, Tom Kenny.
Yeah. I'd say the biggest challenge was not becoming a caricature of SpongeBob, which is a very easy thing to kind of strive towards, because you know you really want the audience to you know see the character that they all know and love, and so Tina was very adamant about making these characters grounded and human, and I think that is why this show works, and so really delving into the humanity of SpongeBob SquarePants was super challenging but super rewarding.
And I'm sorry, I called you Vince for some reason.
That's okay. That's okay.
It's still
I like Vince.
It's a good Italian name.
I like
right?
Vince. Yeah, I'll take Vince. You can call me whatever you want.
Daria, what are some of your favorite moments for the character Sandy Cheeks?
Yeah. Well, Sandy has a very interesting journey throughout the show, and it's a journey that only she gets to go on. You know, as you know, everyone has to face the fact that, you know, Bikini Bottom is facing this terrible disaster, but only Sandy has to, you know, worry about the fact that this town with all these people and her beloved community are turning against her. And I think that the fact that she makes the decision to kind of put those things aside and put her own, you know, personal issues with that aside and, you know, use her smarts and use that loyalty and use the importance of friendship to save the day. I think that is something that I look up to in Sandy. And I try to really make that be something that, you know, comes across every night.
Nice. Now, this is both of yours first national tours.
It is, yeah.
So you must be discovering cities that you've never been to or maybe don't want to go to. Nonetheless, we'll be going to.
Sure, yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
How much of the some 25 additional cities between now and August are you guys signed on for?
Yeah, I mean, it's so thus far we've had so many like amazing experiences in all these cities, and I know I personally have not seen a lot of America until this point.
No, me either.
And so it's been really cool. Even we got to go to Toronto, and that was amazing, especially, you know, coming from like the desert and going to like big cities and stuff. It's amazing. And now we're in San Francisco, and you know, I'm loving the weather. I'm loving the people, the hills.
Don't be fooled.
You know,
yeah. Toronto has pizza vending machines. Just a fun fact. Pretty intense.
Wow. Is that where the tour started, up in Toronto? Or?
No.
It started in New York, in Schenectady, New York.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Nice. And so we have to call out, in addition to the amazing design, that David Zinn, who won a Tony Award for set design for this production on Broadway, also did the set design for Sting's The Last Ship, which goes into that very theater. And starting next week when you guys vacate, I'm going to be talking with Sting next week or in 2 weeks from now about that. And just the production numbers. Oh my gosh. It's just the ensemble numbers are just aghast to see such enthusiasm and choreography on stage.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that the music, the choreography, the costumes, all in themselves are reasons to come see the show. You know, SpongeBob being that show that we all grew up with and, you know, these awesome characters that you want to go out and see, I think, you know, that could be a reason. But, you know, if you just want a night of good music and a night of, you know, an amazing spectacle and an experience like that, I think the reasons are enough to come see the show.
Well, we just talked about the great musical Chicago by Kander and Ebb, and also Cabaret and others. But this isn't a Kander and Ebb musical. This is a book by Kyle Jarrow, but with music by an incredible laundry list of amazing people. Steven Tyler and Joe Perry of Aerosmith, Jonathan Coulton contributed a number, The Flaming Lips contributed a couple numbers, Cyndi Lauper, John Legend, Plain White Tees, They Might Be Giants, David Bowie and Brian Eno.
Yeah.
It's just an extraordinary laundry list of amazing writing.
It's unreal.
Yeah. So if your style is country pop, if your style is, you know, disco, if your style is hip hop, you know, if it's traditional musical theater, there is a number in this musical for everyone. And then they're all beautifully strung together and they all help tell this one cohesive story. So I think that's brilliant in the way that we have all these music styles in one 2 hour sitting.
Yeah,
it's
and the fact that they somehow all fit together in one cohesive unit is incredible.
They do.
It's really extraordinary. I do have to give a shout out to you, Lorenzo, for the amazing gymnastic ability that you just, like, even while singing, especially while climbing ladders that represent Mount Humongous. You have the body of a gymnast. Was that a characteristic for the role? I mean, a requirement for the role?
I don't know if it was a
plus.
A requirement, but I guess a plus. I've always been kind of an athlete. I wanted to be a baseball player actually for a while. But yeah, I've always had a lot of energy and just enjoy running around. So being on those ladders, it's just like a day at the jungle gym, really.
And over and over again.
Yes,
my
yes, yes, yes.
You don't have quite the gymnastics involved for you.
Not quite. I do some karate chops in there.
Yeah, chop to the top is pretty.
No, it
running
is.
Running around on those carts. Yeah.
It is.
It's also a show that is subtly tapping into the current cultural zeitgeist
yeah.
in terms of, the references of land mammals go home,
mm-hmm.
you know, the prejudices that arise in today in the fictional world of Bikini Bottom.
Yeah, what I think the show does a beautiful job of doing is it inspires empathy from the audience because, you know, these aren't just like, this isn't a bunch of random people in a random scenario and a random story. These are characters that everyone knows, whether you actually sat down and watched an episode of SpongeBob where, you know, you were a parent glancing over your kid's shoulder watching an episode, you know who these characters are, which makes you feel kind of closer to them. So
yeah.
when a character that you know and you can personally connect to is being treated in that way, it inspires that kind of energy to want to change that I think that would be harder to inspire if there was someone you didn't know,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mentioned the incredible composers involved. The Plain White Tees has one of the great numbers, a great production number, BFF. Do you have a BFF?
Do I have a BFF?
Do you have a BFF?
Yes, I have many a BFF, actually.
How about you, Daria?
Oh, yes, I do. I do, indeed.
Tell us about the number BFF, and we'll play it out.
Yeah, BFF is really just a song, kind of a celebration of SpongeBob and Patrick's friendship. You know, they really just love each other. They're the ideal friends, and I think that's what the song's all about. It's a lot of fun.
Lorenzo Pugliese and Daria Pilar Ritas, stars of the SpongeBob musical at Golden Gate Theater, Market and Taylor, only through this Sunday. Now, there are matinees and evening performances on both Saturday and Sunday, so you have a good chance to do it. shnsf.com for more information. Thank you guys so much for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks
Appreciate
for having us.
Here's BFF from the original cast recording of SpongeBob SquarePants.
I got you and you got me. I don't need my glasses on to see we're both pretty lucky. Stuck inside with no TV. Being bored with you makes me as happy as can be. Let's have some fun together. We'll be best friends forever. BFF, that stands for us.
Life is sweet. There's snacks we can eat.
We'll have fun if we go out or just sit around doing nothing. Let's explore, open every drawer.
Hey, you found my long-lost cheese.
Well, that's what friends are for. Let's have some fun together.
You're my best friend forever.
BFF, that stands for
We're best friends and this is the friend dance. We're best friends and this is the friend dance. We're best friends and this is the friend dance. We're best friends and
every little thing that I can think of doing just sounds better doing it together. Every little thing that I can think of doing just sounds better doing it together, doing it with you. Floating high like a bubble.
SpongeBob and Patrick.
That stands for us.
Oh! Oh, isn't that sweet? From SpongeBob SquarePants, the original cast recording. That was Ethan Slater singing that. You can catch SpongeBob or just a few more performances here in San Francisco at the Golden Gate Theater. Let's take a trip to Bikini Bottom, though, for one more track from this really incredibly creative musical. This is Bikini Bottom Day.
Good morning, world, and all who inhabit it. Jump out of bed, mix up a breakfast for my favorite pet snail. Full steam ahead, the SS I am ready is about to set sail. This cat day couldn't get much better, but it keeps on trying. I'm on my way, somewhere there's a Krabby Patty that needs frying. And who's the lucky sponge in the mirror who is living his dream? Who's always extra careful with his dental hygiene? Gary, it's me, happy just to be here in the world renowned. Bikini Bottom, how I love this town. Bikini Bottom, when the sun shines down on a beautiful Bikini Bottom day. Good morning, Patrick.
Is it morning already?
It sure is, and I'm singing an opening number.
Ooh, I want a verse. I missed a snack. This busy schedule makes it hard to be me. To stay on track, now I'll have to eat it while I'm watching TV. There might not be time for a nap, but I'll do what I can. They're showing all the episodes of Mermaid Man. Oh, every single one. I'm spending all day underneath my favorite rock.
You two, please keep it down.
Good morning, Squidward.
Another day, another migraine. When I want some quiet, there's nowhere to go.
A sensitive artiste can't get a moment's peace with these two.
Well, that's a great lyric to lead into my next guest. Where you want some quietness to go. Experiential music company Mind Travel presents its signature live to headphones, silent piano, silent hike, and floating meditation experience throughout the year on gorgeous beaches and beautiful parks and other stunning outdoor spaces such as the Brooklyn Botanic Garden and iconic spaces such as Grace Cathedral here in San Francisco. It could be for 100 or 1,000 people. And this magical experience is all about mindfulness. And I'm so pleased to welcome Murray Hittery, the multidisciplinary artist and tech pioneer who created this. It's brought him acclaim as a visual artist and global recognition as a musician. Murray is now focused on touring his immersive musical experience, Mind Travel, across the globe. Now, just over the past 5 years, Murray has created over 500 Mind Travel experiences for over 100,000 peoples in cities from L.A. to London, Paris to Pittsburgh, Berlin to Boulder, in amazing venues. Next stop for this Sunday's experience is on the 16th at 5 p.m. through the underwater tunnels and into the Aquarium Farallon Room. There's also a separate Mind Travel and Yoga on the Labyrinth on the 18th at Grace Cathedral. Murray Hittery joins me now by phone. Murray, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
Great, thank you. Wow, where are you, by the way, right now?
I'm right now in Los Angeles, where we had some events down here, and I'll be heading up to San Francisco this weekend. I'm really excited to come up there and bring Mind Travel with me.
Well, fortunately, you're in for some excellent weather as well, so it should be a nice experience for everyone.
Fantastic.
Let's talk first about how this thing got started. It came from a very personal experience of yours and some loss.
Very much so. Music has always been a real language of expression for me starting as a little kid. I started playing when I was 5-6 years old, and I knew I wanted to be a composer in high school, and that's what I ended up studying in university, to be a classical composer and pianist. And I used music as my way to connect both internally with my own feelings and emotions, and also to kind of understand the universe, you know, in a broader way. And so music was always that language for me. And then about 13 years ago, one of the most difficult, if not the most difficult moment of my life, when my little sister at 23 died suddenly and tragically in an accident, and I was traveling with her and had to go through that and deal with that just incredible loss and everything that comes with that. And I turned to music as a way to process the grief, as a way to process the emotions, the pain, and to really feel it out of me. And that was the process that I personally went through. And I saw kind of how it was able to transform the pain of the grief into the pure love that I had and still have for my sister. So that is something that I then created into an experience that I can share with others that I call Mind Travel. And it's about really transporting people and creating wonder and giving space for reflection and the processing of whatever comes up.
Well, I think we all need this right now, a dose of mindfulness with our antidepressants and outrageous news that is seemingly foisted on us at every minute. We need to step back and breathe.
Absolutely. And, you know, connecting with nature, David, is such a powerful ingredient to this. And so when I bring it to locations around the world, like in San Francisco, you know, we'll be bringing it to the Aquarium of the Bay, and we'll literally be walking under the bay, under the water in those glass tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
And we start out as a silent walk where I put headphones on all the participants that we provide. And I have my music playing through there, and I guide a mindfulness experience under the water, walking through these tunnels, looking at the wildlife, looking at nature. And then we all gather in the larger room where I actually play live and take people on an improvised real-time composition at the piano, connecting with nature and with each other.
That's lovely. Now, at first, the idea of a silent walk, everyone with headphones on, with a group of others, seemed contradictory to me because you're in your own world versus the group experience. But how have you discovered that the synergy and the connectedness happens?
It's incredible because it does. It seems counterintuitive to think that you can find deeper connection with others by being silent. But it's incredible how through the experience of both nature and the music, that just being still in presence allows a deeper connection than some trivial words that might be shared, you know, between strangers. And so when we all go through the experience together, we're going much deeper than just, hi, what's your name, what do you do, you know, some kind of superficial conversation. It's really about having an experience together.
Mm.
And once we do that, we are bonding on a much deeper level.
Wow. You've been doing these all over the world, as I mentioned. What's the most iconic place that you've done then?
Well, you know, I'm from New York originally, so I brought it to Central Park, which, you know, in the heart of Manhattan, was pretty special to have it there. Really, you know, incredible theaters like Lincoln Center and, of course, the Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. We've done it across the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco as well. So just really looking at those iconic, you know, landmarks, whether natural or, you know, human-made.
And where does it head from here? What other cities are set up at this point?
So right after the this weekend on Sunday and then the 18th at the Grace Cathedral, I embark on a cross-country tour, and we're going coast-to-coast to 70 cities over the coming months.
Wow.
And we'll be taking it everywhere from, you know, Miami to Mobile to Biloxi to Galveston to Austin during South by Southwest. I mean, we're just going to be everywhere. So it's going to be quite the effort, and I can't wait to really meet people in their, you know, local cities, taking in these incredible parks and outdoor environments and nature in all the different states. I think we're hitting about 46 or 47 states in this tour.
And will you be playing live at all of them?
Yes, I'll be playing live at many of them, and in the cases where, like, we're walking, you know, through a forest up a mountain, right, well, those will be just the silent hikes, the silent walks.
Fantastic. You can learn more at mindtravel.com or search on Facebook as well for Murray Hittery and the Silent Walk. Murray, I wish you a calming experience in L.A., if that's possible. And then for the trip up here, we look forward to having everyone just take a deep breath. Thanks for being with me.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me, David. Bye.
Composer, pianist, entrepreneur Marie Hittery is part of his Mind Travel soundtrack, playing live and recorded music, a chance to experience some mindfulness. Once again, this coming Sunday at 5 p.m. through the underwater tunnels and into the Aquarium Farallon Room at Pier 39, and a separate mind travel and yoga on the Labyrinth on February 18th at Grace Cathedral, also at 5 p.m. You can learn more at mindtravel.com or search for Silent Walk on Facebook or for Marie Hittery. That's H-I-D-A-R-Y. Links to all of the guests here on Open Air are at our website, kalw.org. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing Open Air. I'm David Latulib. You can email me, david@kalw.org. Our shows are archived at kalw.org as well. Thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show. Next week on Open Air, I'll be talking with clarinetist and co-founder Sarah Bonomo of the Conductorless Collaborative Chamber Orchestra, One Found Sound. I'll also talk with actor and playwright John Fisher about the world premiere of his new play, Radical, a satirical drama about SF politics that's playing at the Theater Rhino. And I'll have conductor and violinist Dawn Harms on once again to talk about the concerts that she's doing with the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony, utilizing the Violins of Hope that were also talked about on a previous Open Air. That's next week at 1 o'clock. I hope you can join me. Thanks for listening.